The Tennis Worthy podcast today takes you back to the 70s, arguably the most exciting decade in tennis. Hi, I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and we have a fascinating interview for you with someone who was both a participant and a ringside spectator in world tennis in the 1970s. He was a player, a Grand Slam singles runner-up, a Davis Cup finalist, and happened to be married to one of the biggest names in tennis. He is John Lloyd.
When you've been around great players as I have, seeing them around and being married to Chris Evert, who was one of the greatest players of all time, you sort of see the difference between them and someone like myself. And I think it really comes down to the desire to win. When you're in the locker rooms, hang around with the winners, the big guys, if you get a chance. Don't hang around with the ones that have got excuses that say, God, I had bad luck today. Don't. The top players don't have excuses. You will wake up tomorrow and you'll be 30 and your career will be almost over. Do not waste another day. Come out of this game, whatever it is that you've given 100%. And if you end up being ranked 400 in the world, so be it.
When tennis went open in 1968, it unleashed an exciting new wave of changes, from playing styles to fashions, from worldwide exposure to behavior, from surfaces to roofs. In this brave new world, John Lloyd was something of a playboy, as well as a highly gifted tennis player. And when he married Chris Evert, they became the glamour couple of the sport. But the lessons John Lloyd learned along the way are worth every young player and every parent knowing. His insights into what makes a champion and the difference between very good players and great players really are worth hearing. Chris Bowers caught up with John in the margins in the 2024 Hall of Fame induction weekend. Enjoy.
John Lloyd, we're recording this in the Museum of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What do you think it is that makes somebody a Hall of Famer?
Well, there's a difference between being good players, and the word I think is the most overused word with TV commentators and people just around the game that say he or she is a great player. And for me, great is something special. And I think to players that are in the Hall of Fame, they have been great players. Talking about sort of myself briefly, I was 21 in the world. I was a good player, a really good player. But greatness is totally different. And when you've been around great players, as I have, seeing them around and being married to Chris Evert, who was one of the greatest players of all time, you sort of see the difference between them and someone like myself. And I think it really comes down to the desire to win, the desire to be the best. I think the great players, and I'm not sure whether you're born with it. I think if you're a coach, you can help someone get that sort of be more stronger out there mentally. But I don't know whether you can really coach it, not to the ends where the great players go. And I've been around them. You realize that if it's a game of tiddlywinks, they want to win. There's something about them in their DNA that I think separates from the good to the greats.
Is there a borderline? And obviously there is, but it's very difficult to define. Where does somebody cease to be good and become great? Because it's very easy, especially with Djokovic winning 24 Grand Slams, to say, oh, it's a certain number. But it's got to be more than just a number.
Yeah, I think anybody that, for me, wins multiple slams in singles, you have to say is a great player. Because to win, the slams are so difficult. To win seven matches on whichever surface it is, all the slams are as difficult as the others when you look at it. It's something special to know because all the players peak for the slams. The other tournaments in the world, they're important and they're nice, but, you can get a top player on a bad day or whatever and, they're maybe not as hungry as. But when it comes down to slams, everybody is their peak of their fitness mentally and physically. And to win seven matches and to do it multiple times. I can give a quick story about when I was married to Chris Evert, who, if you really analyze her game and you look at it, she wasn't a tall person. She was average. Speed-wise, she was okay. She looked a lot quicker than she was, and the reason was because she anticipated very well. But in terms of actually her twitch muscle, she was okay, nothing special. Her serve was just almost a means of getting the ball into the court. She never served an ace hardly in her life. And if you look at her ground strokes, the forehand was good, very good, but nothing unbelievable. And the backhand was the money shot. That backhand was incredible. Volleys were nice, but she never went to the net apart from shaking hands after she won the match. So you look at that. Well, why did she win as many as she did? Well, because her desire to win was beyond belief, the focus that she had. One year she played at Wimbledon, and she played Martina Navratilova in the semifinals. And I can't remember, I was coaching Chris at the time, as well as being her husband. And I can't remember how many times she'd lost to Martina, but it was a lot, and especially on grass. And she went into that match in the semifinals, and I think she was about a 6-1 to 8-1 underdog. And to be honest, I don't think she thought she was going to win. I certainly didn't. Of course, I didn't tell her that. And I don't think many people did. She ended up beating Martina in an epic match. And when she came off court, I believe, if I'm right here, that they didn't have an extra day off before the finals because I think it had rained. I might be wrong here, but that's what I believe. But whatever it was, anyway, when she came home that night, we had a house in Kingston. And in those days, of course, there was no internet or anything like that. But we got back late by the time she finished. And the phone was ringing off the hook with people calling her from Florida and all her friends, parents. And because, I think everybody was shocked as well as she was. And they just kept talking with her. And after about 11 o'clock at night, I remember saying to Chris, look, you've got a finals to play tomorrow. And she said, don't worry about it. I'll be fine in the finals. She woke up that day and I could tell she was flat. Anyway, she ended up losing to Yvonne, which was a big surprise. So we got on the plane the next day back to Miami, which is a 10-hour flight. That's where we used to live in Fort Lauderdale. And Chris, when she lost, was not exactly a happy bunny, that's for sure. And me being a husband and her coach, I would take the brunt of that, which was fair enough. It's understandable. But so I was not looking forward to that journey home because she hadn't spoken to me since she lost, basically. And in those days, there were no videos on the plane, so I couldn't watch a movie. So I had to pretend to read. And then she's in the window seat looking like she'd like to parachute out and jump out of it because she'd lost. And as we got close to landing, I thought to myself, now, what would John Lloyd, you know, a good player who had got to the finals of Wimbledon, what would I do after I'd lost in the final? Myself, I'd go to Maui and have a week or 2 weeks under the sun and congratulate myself and enjoy myself. So I said to Chris as we were landing, I thought I'd better break the ice. And I said, look, you know, bad luck in the finals, great tournament. Why don't we go for a nice week's holiday and just chill out? You had a great tournament other than the finals, blah, blah, blah. And she looked at me and she said, are you nuts? And I said, well, people do say that, but not, I didn't think at the time. And she said, as soon as we land, when we get back to our house, and you're talking about in the summer, in Fort Lauderdale. It was about 100 degrees and 100% humidity. And she said, I want to go straight out on the court, change, put your tennis stuff on, and I want to play for 2 or 3 hours. I don't want to ever lose to her again. And I went, okay. And I thought to myself, I mean, it's a silly little story, but it's one of many.
That's the great and the good.
Right. I would never have thought about doing something like that in a billion years. I would have been very satisfied. And I would have thought, hey, we'll do it next time. Chris was like, it's never going to happen again. I'm going to punish myself to make sure it doesn't. And that, to me, is just a little example of what separates the good from the great.
We'll come back to the greatest a little later, but you grew up in a family immersed in tennis.
Yes.
Your dad was well established. You had an elder brother, David, who was a very accomplished tennis player, even though he's better known as a businessman.
Right.
Your younger brother also played. The next generation have got roles in tennis. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a very good thing. I look back at my childhood living down near Southend-on-Sea, and I was thinking, you know, what a wonderful life I had there. I mean, because the family were all involved. But I have to say, I give a lot of credit to my parents because I've seen some nutty parents in my time on the tennis circuit, and they're still around. In fact, now it's even worse than in my day. But it was a stress-free relationship with the great sport that we love. And to have the three brothers, and to have my brother who was 7 years older than me, and when I started playing, he was already in the top 3 or 4 in the country. And then my younger brother, Tony, followed me. we would spend our weekends at the tennis club all day long at a lovely family club called Westive Hard Courts. And my parents, my mother would make us salads and food, and we'd go down there from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 at night. And we would just mix in with other tennis families and families at the club and just spend all day there playing tennis, playing football on the field there, going to the beach, and then the parents would play their tennis, and in the afternoon they would play with the kids. For me, it was such a great, healthy environment. I think some of it these days, when you grow up in a tennis family, the pressure that the parents put on the kids, to me, it's not something I would have liked to have done. I certainly didn't do that with my children, and my parents didn't do that with us. So even though we were professionals, we all became professionals. In fact, one year, all three of us played singles at Wimbledon, which I think is a record, David, Tony and myself. But I think it was a healthy environment. And we talked about tennis, but we did other things as well.
It sounds great fun.
Yeah,
spending all that time at the tennis club. And yeah. I'm sure it was a very nurturing environment. Is it the best environment for getting the best out of yourself as a tennis player?
Well, I look back at it and I think, see, my brother David was and is, he had that gene of wanting to succeed at anything, and he certainly did so in business. And he wasn't the most talented player. I mean, he was damn good, don't get me wrong. We got the final of the Davis Cup, and in doubles we got the semis of Wimbledon and so on, but he wasn't naturally gifted, but his work ethic was incredible. And I kind of had, you know, I was lucky I had a, you know, reasonable amount of ability, but mentally I wasn't as strong as him. I think it's still a good thing to be in an environment like that. But the only thing I would say is that my parents, particularly my father, who was my coach, he was fantastic. But there was one thing that I look back at over the years, and I'm not in any way blaming my father for my inadequacies at the top of the game. But I remember a couple of examples where the difference between, as an example, an American parent and a British parent. Now, and I'm generalizing because it's not always, but I heard a lot of it when I was playing. A sort of example would be if I played at a tournament in England and I upset the top seed or one of the top seeds when I was growing up. Now, I was obviously very happy at the match, and I'd be afterwards and sitting there with my dad. And then some friend of my father's would come up and say to him, "Oh my gosh, John played so well. I mean, if he plays like this, you know, he could win the tournament, you know, in the second or third round this was." Now, an American parent would have said, "Sure, you're right about that. Of course he's going to win the tournament," which that's putting pressure on a little bit the other way for me. Whereas my father went too far the other way. Now, I look back at, you know, when I look back at it, he would say, "Well, you know, John played really well. This is just one match. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow." So in some ways, that sort of puts a little doubt. It did in my mind. I look back at it, and I'm not blaming him at all. It was my own. But it was almost like, well, if it doesn't succeed, you know, you might play one great match, but you might in the next step, but it's okay. Whereas an American parent, I'm not saying it's good or bad, they would say, you know, you're damn right he's going to win the tournament.
So what conclusion do you draw, apart from the fact that there's no such thing as perfect parenting? Because ultimately, if your child does not go on to be a professional tennis player, then it's very healthy to say, look, it's great if you win, but it doesn't matter if you don't.
Right.
But if they are likely to go on, then you do need to give them the necessary kick.
Yeah. Well, I think it's in between. I mean, if I did it, I mean, my kids played a bit of tennis, but they were not in that way. But if that happened to me with my child, and he had played a great match, whether it was my son or my daughter, and someone said that exact same, I said, you know what? He's playing so well. You know, he's capable of doing anything, and he's ready for it one match at a time. Corny, but that's what I would have said, rather than, well, hold on a minute here. You know, or the other way, we're going, goddamn right, he's going to win it. I think there's a middle ground to that.
When you were a junior and you were winning lots of matches at tournaments, what were you doing to win when basically from the age of what, about 8, 9, 10, you were probably hitting the same sort of forehands and backhands as all the people you were playing? What actually made you win matches?
Well, I think I was fortunate that my father was a very smart man in tennis coaching. I think he taught obviously the three boys and went on to teach a lot of other junior champions in England. And he had a very good philosophy about the game. And when we practiced and played with him, his goal was to always think about us joining the senior tour. He didn't put as much stock into junior tennis. Yes, he wanted us to win. But I remember a few times, as an example, I would play a couple of years up in my age, and I'd play against someone that was a road runner, and I could not beat them for a couple of years. And I was frustrated, and I would be trying to hit my balls, and my dad would say, look, you keep working on it, it's going to happen, but I'm telling you this right now, you'll beat this person one time and then you'll never lose them again, because they're training to be a good junior, and they're going to win a lot of matches in juniors because they're physically stronger at the time, and they're road runners. You have got to look at what is going to take you through to the next level. And so my father was very proactive. He taught me a lot about how to hit the ball on the rise. He was always very aggressive in terms of where the way he wanted me to play. He wasn't a traditionalist in some ways. I mean, my forehand was never a correct continental, a bit of a continental forehand, but he said, look, you'll be able to maneuver around with that, but my backhand was my best shot. He always went to your strengths and taught me that work on your strength, of course your weaknesses too, but you've got enough ability. You know, he always called me a shot maker and let me go for it, and said some of these balls are going out, but they will go in eventually if you keep on going for it sensibly. So he always had a very good, I thought, very good philosophy about coaching.
So he was happy for you to lose matches without him losing confidence in your overall ability. But if you've got a system whereby you've got to keep on winning a certain number of matches for your funding or for your national association to keep up the support, I mean, that's not going to leave much room for individual development, for the idea of building an all-court game or, you know, one-handed backhand or just something that might be particular to a certain player. How do we get around that?
Well, yeah, it's not easy. I mean, I think my father wanted me to win junior matches. He didn't want me to have a cop out and say, well, just keep going for it, and if it, you know, someday it will work out. And he wanted me to obviously focus and try hard in every match. But he just looked at the big picture, and it is difficult with funding and everything else. But I was good enough, thank goodness, that even with, you know, my sort of long-term aim to be a senior player, I was always ranked in the top three or four in the country at my age level. So I always got, well, funding is not like it is now. I mean, getting rackets and clothes was my funding. Certainly didn't get any help financially. The LTA would give me a little bit here and there, but I had to rely on sponsors, actually, that would help me out. And obviously, as my ranking got better, I got more and more. And then eventually you started to get some money from the clothes and shoes and rackets and all that stuff. But you're right, there's a fine line behind, because tennis is an expensive sport. I know we've tried to make it not so, but it just is. And so you're absolutely right. You've got to win matches to get the support, but you've also got to take the long view of where a player is going to be. I love watching the juniors at Wimbledon, as an example, in the tournament. I sometimes go around and watch, and I commentate on the semis and the finals. And I'm always looking to see whether I think that they've got the game to make the transition. And some of them, I can see a good juniors, but they're never going to make it. And so you just wonder. And I see all the parents and the agents, and all they're thinking about is where they're going to be in the top five in the world in juniors. But really, it means nothing in the future. If you haven't been proactive with what you need to be a top player, being a junior champion is nice, but all it does, it wins you a few trophies, which will be forgotten about when you try and make it on the tour.
But by the time they're playing junior Grand Slams, they're effectively fully formed players.
Yeah.
The person I have in mind is Dominic Thiem, who hit with a two-handed backhand, and then his coach said, look, I think you should work with a one-handed backhand. But it took him 18 months, where his results dropped. He went from top junior to 10th in his age group during the learning phase. Will today's parents and coaches and federations allow that to happen so that we can generate players who are true to themselves and ultimately have a more varied crop of players for the tour?
It's a very good question, and I think that goes down to when you've got that type of thing happening, you've got to hope that you have very good coaches in place that see the future. Because if you just go on, strictly speaking, on results, obviously you're putting yourself into one little pocket. It's like the great Robert Lansdorf, who's a coach in California. I went and watched him coach, and you know, I loved his philosophy of where he got players on the court. And basically, you know, for a week or whatever, he would almost try and break them down physically and mentally to see what they had in them. And if, you know, if some of them would cry and some of them would go to their parents who were watching. And when they did that, he would say, thank you very much to the parents. But, you know, Johnny or Mary is not welcome back in my coaching realm again. And it's brutally honest. But I think back to the old days and past my day, but I'm talking about where, you know, at the LTA, and I remember going to the NTC, and this was
the National Tennis Centre.
Yes, National Tennis Centre.
Where was that at the time?
That was in Roehampton.
It was in
Roehampton. When they built the one. And I, at that stage, we didn't have a very good crop of players. And I remember going along there, and you have the row of courts. And I, in my capacity, I had no say in it. It wasn't my job. And I'm not going to go in there and tell coaches or the top people that you've got no chance with these. That's not my job. If they'd have asked me, I would have said it. But I was in a different role. But I remember looking at that and seeing these players that they were spending thousands on. And me, myself, I could tell just by watching them practice in an hour that they were not going to make it. I could just tell because I could hear them. I could see them. At the time, I told the LTA staff, if I was running the game, I would get Robert Lansdorpe over in England for 3 months and go round to all the coaching camps that they have. And he would go in there and he would weed out the players. It would be brutal, but he's going to be right 9 times out of 10. Now, is he going to get it wrong once? Yeah. But if that happens, that person that proves him wrong is going to end up being a better player anyway.
Okay, so brutal question. If Robert Lansdorpe had come along when you were 8, 9, 10 years old, would he have weeded you out or would he have kept you in?
Well, I hope and I think that he would have seen something in me, the way I played. I mean, mentally, I mean, would I have broken down with him? I think I would have got through it. I might have not liked it as much. I was a decently hardworking junior, not as much as I should have been. The only time I really worked as hard as I should have done, which is what I've always regretted in my career, was when I hooked up with Bob Brett when I was 28 years old and my career was right down in the dumper. I was ranked in the 400s and I was actually going to retire, and then I had one last shot at it. And that was really the only time I worked at my capacity was with Bob Brett. And unfortunately, I got back to 21 in the world, but it was a bit late in the day. So that's a good question, what you said. Would he have seen something with my attitude? I would hope that he would have done, that he would have seen in my game that there was something in that he could have helped, and that it was worthwhile the effort to make me be the player that I ended up being, you know, a decent player, you know.
Going back to your family life, there were a lot of people who said, well, if John had had David's grit, or if David had had John's natural talent,
right,
you'd have had a really good player there. Was there anything you should perhaps have learnt more from your elder brother's ability to just find the right solutions? Or is there anything more he should have? I suppose you can't develop the natural talent as much. You had that. Should you have done more?
Definitely. Absolutely. And that's the one thing I do regret about my tennis career. When I do speaking engagements, or when I was Davis Cup captain and some of the younger players, you know, I told them, you know, if they wanted to listen, I just said, look, trust me on this one. These are when they were 19, 18 years old. You will wake up tomorrow and you'll be 30 and your career will be almost over. You cannot, do not waste another day. Come out of this game, whatever it is that you've given 100%. And if you end up being ranked 400 in the world, so be it, because you've gone for it 100%. And I regret that for me, that I didn't do that. And yes, I should have learned from David. I should have learned more from Chris, to tell you the truth. But I didn't. I didn't really until the latter part, when I finally did it for myself, that I wanted to try and at least come out of the game. That's the only real part of my tennis career that I was proud of, was when I was 28 years old and going back into the qualifying, 400 in the world, I had plenty of money. I was married to Chris. I'd made good money myself. I didn't need to do that. And in the qualifying in my day, it was not like it is now, where you get prize money in the qualifying and you get umpires and lines people on every court and you've got ball boys and ball girls. In my day, a lot of the clubs, you had one umpire and you had people that were cheating. And, you know, you're staying in, well, I didn't stay in crappy places because I afford it, but all the other players were gunning for me because here I am showing up and I'm taking bread off their table and I didn't need to financially. But I had a goal, and that was the only time I really had a goal. And I regret it that I left it really late in my career to do that.
So if the John Lloyd of the Davis Cup captain years had spoken to the John Lloyd of your teenage years, would the teenage John Lloyd have heard?
Probably not, because I look back at it and the coaching at the beginning, I obviously made my father, but my father, when I was 15, he said, I've done all I can for you. And then John Barrett helped me a little bit, or a lot actually. And then Roger Becker, they sort of passed me on, so to speak. And I was with Dennis Rolton, who was a great coach, and I didn't really do that well with Dennis. And people say, ah, Dennis. But if you don't really want it, you could have the greatest coach in the world. You could have Robert Lansdorp. You could have whatever. But if you don't really want to go for the full 100% and go for it, I don't care how good the coach is, it's not going to work. And so in answer to your question, no, I wouldn't have done, because I was not at that stage in my life where I'd gone far enough down where I'd thought, okay, this is your last chance. Do you want to end up, you know, look back at your career as a complete waste of time in terms of the talent you had? Or do you want to at least put on some sort of, for yourself, not for anybody else, but for yourself, to show deep down that this is what I could do? And I look back at it, and people say, could you have been better? No doubt. I was 21 in the world twice, once when I was, you know, 22, and I got the final of three tournaments in the space of 4 months. The Swiss
Open.
One of
which was a slam.
Well, one was a slam. The Swiss Open, I lost to Borg in the final there. Then I lost at the Wembley Arena, which was a big tournament in those days, to Borg again, and then lost to Gerulaitis. And I remember John Barrett, my mentor, said, you've got two different paths now. You can take the path where you congratulate yourself and enjoy the riches that are going to come your way and the fame, or you can work doubly as hard. Well, you can guess which one I chose.
Did you choose it consciously? Or did you think, oh, I'm sure it'll carry on going up, I just don't need to do the work?
Well, I just thought I was good enough to kind of breeze through it, and I was making plenty of money. I was going out with some very nice ladies. I was enjoying myself, and, you know, I saw some of the things that the top guys did, and I thought, nah, I don't know if that's for me.
Okay, that then throws an interesting question up, which is, you see players who are ranked around 50, and in an average year, their ranking will go between 30 and 70, up and right, down a little bit. If they're happy with that, shouldn't one say it's a phenomenal achievement? Just as you'd say, well, if the teacher teaching your kids was the 30th best teacher in the world, you'd be very pleased. If your doctor was the 30th best doctor in the world, you'd say, wow, I've got a really good one here. That actually we should be a little bit less condemnatory about players who spend a few years in the top 100, even if they never get beyond about 30.
I totally agree with what you just said, and it's something that kind of irritates me, and it's not just about me particularly, but I remember an example, Tim Henman. I mean, the amount of people that came up to me over the years that said, you know, Tim's just not got it, he just hasn't got it. And I looked at them and I said, he was number 4 in the world. There were only 3 better players than him on the planet. You took that exactly as what you said, as a doctor or a scientist, they would be in every magazine all over the world. And yet in a tennis player, if you don't win a slam, by a lot of the public, you're considered a failure. It's nonsense. When I played twice, there were only 20 players better than me on the planet. Now, it's not bad. I regret it because I didn't do the work as much as I should have done. So I think I could have done better than that. So I regret it. But when people sometimes, you know, you get people on the internet and whatever, and they say, oh, he was a lousy player. Sometimes I have them saying, people saying, well, why should he commentate? Because he wasn't a great player. Well, they're right. I wasn't a great player. But what ranking do you have to have as a player if you're going to go the route of having to be a player to be a commentator, which is also nonsense. But if that's the route you're going, what ranking do you have to have that where you're qualified to commentate on people? It's just such a stupid thing. So I agree totally what you said. I mean, to me, wherever you finish on the ranking list, what I would say to them if I could get into there is when they were young, don't regret it that you finished there because you didn't work hard. If your natural ability was to finish at 50 or 100, 250, and you worked your butt off, well done. Go on to the next phase of your life and look back at it. I gave it everything I had. That's all you can do.
And although you didn't win a slam, you came within one set of one. I mean, that final you lost at the Australian Open was a 5-set final.
Right. I mean, it was, listen, I'm not silly. I know that the Australian Open wasn't the Australian Open it is now. I know that there were, I think we had 4 or 5 players in the top 10 in comparison with now. You get 10 out of the 10. I get that. Jimmy Connors didn't play Borg. I get all that, but you can only beat who's in front of you. And
Gerulaitis was a top player.
Well, Gerulaitis, and I beat Newcomb in the quarters, who was a top 10 player and was in his own country. So it's not like it was just given to me, but it was not obviously what it is now. But I was one set away, and I should have won that match. You see, that to me, that match, again, I look back at it, and mentally I wavered when I had my friend on the ropes who was suffering from cramp, and I didn't crush him like I should have done. I almost for parts there, almost felt sorry for him, because I didn't like to see what was going through. Whereas a Jimmy Connors or a Lendl or a McEnroe, they would have, whatever, they would have drop shot him every ball if he had a bad leg, as an example, or he had cramp. They would have done anything to take just to win, because in their philosophy, the person on the other side of that is the enemy. Well, when you're competitive, of course, it is to a certain extent, but it's not life or death for me, whereas a lot of the top ones, it is. I mean, it really is. I'll just give you another quick example about the greatness. It's another one I threw in about Chris with Jimmy Connors. I mean, this is, again, a silly thing, but I look at it again, because the other thing I would also teach to people now, and when I was on Davis Cup, when you're in the locker rooms, hang around with the winners, the big guys, if you get a chance. Don't hang around with the ones that have got excuses that say, God, I had bad luck today. Don't. The top players don't have excuses. Hang around them. Try and be their practice partners. Jimmy Connors, one time in Philadelphia, we used to play at a place called the Spectrum. This was in the old days. Again, facilities not like they were now. We only had one court. There was no practice because the matches were men's and singles and doubles and went on till 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 or 3 o'clock. The only practice was at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they would let you play for an hour, but 15 minutes each, four on a court. That was it. And we both, Jimmy and I both won a match or so, and I happened to be hanging around with him this week, and he said, look, we're going to do something different tonight. And I said, what's that? He said, we're going to go over to the Spectrum at 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're going to play you and me for an hour in singles. I said, are you off your head? I'm sleeping. He said, no. Trust me, that's what we've got to do. And I managed to persuade myself, and it was freezing cold in the middle of the night in Philadelphia in December. They had to put on the lights and went out there. I mean, they didn't have the heating on. It was like playing in an ice box. And the first half an hour, I couldn't see a ball, and Jimmy's like in my face, like, because every practice session for him is like the finals of Wimbledon. But we finished the hour, and afterwards he said, you realise what we've done, don't you? And I said, yeah, I've lost a whole night's sleep. And he said, no. Psychologically, we've got one over the rest of the players in the field. We're the only ones that have practiced. It's a psychological advantage. And he won the tournament. I lost the next round. I was exhausted. But my point is, that was his mindset. And my mindset was, no, I wanted the extra sleep. A little example, but I think it's sort of...
It's very relevant.
Yeah, I think it's relevant.
Yeah. What was it like in the mid-70s? I mean, tennis went open in 1968, and there was that... The end of the Aussie generation, there was Nastasi, there was Jimmy Connors and Chris Evert, there was Borg.
Yeah.
A great time to play.
Yes.
Was it perhaps a little distracting for someone who wasn't absolutely single-minded?
Oh, no question. For me, it was I fell right into that. I mean, it was the era, the Borg, Connors, the TV era came along there, and tennis was like... It was the sport to play, especially in America. Well, in Britain, but in America, it became just like this. This was the sport that everyone wanted to watch, everyone wanted to play. And, I mean, the parties and the celebrity stuff that went on, and if you wanted to take advantage of it, which, of course, I did, it was a big distraction, that's for sure. But it was a wonderful time, and I don't regret. I loved that era because I made friends there and had experiences that, quite frankly, the players of today will never have, because now it's a business. My day wasn't as much as a business. Now, which would I prefer? It's a tough one because the finances, of course, you know, if I'd have been 21 in the world then and what now, I would be probably lying on a beach right now. But we had some great times. I mean, I look back at it and think, God, I was lucky. I mean, to play in that era, to play against the great characters, and we played a brand of tennis and we hung around with each other. There wasn't these entourages where you get these groups now where they've got managers, they've got a physiotherapist and they've got the nutritionist and then they've got the coach and you've got 7-8 people around. They're in these little pockets. And I mean, I'm talking about the top ones, the lesser ones, even they seem to have 2 or 3 people around them. My era, until towards the end, I mean, you really couldn't afford even a coach, let alone anybody else. And so the guys were on the road and you lose matches. And it was like, hey, let's go out tonight and see if we can get lucky. You know, have fun and eat in great restaurants. And I mean, when I played Vitas in the final of the Australian, we were out most nights, to be honest. We were practice partners. We were going out with some of the drivers. In those days, they had one of the cigarette companies. And We would go out with them. And
yes, the cigarette company was a title sponsor of the tournament.
Correct. And in those days, it wasn't taboo to go out with people that were driving. Now you can't do that, but in my day you could. So we would go out with some lovely ladies, and next day, well, let's practice tomorrow at 10. Okay. And we show up, and we prayed. We practiced almost every day together, and we practiced the day of the finals as well. It's a different world then. You can't. I do actually kind of laugh at some of the top players when they get interviewed, and they always, you know, they say the right things, most of them, because they're coached to do it. And, you know, it's like, oh, what about him? And they go, oh, yeah, we're great friends. And I'm thinking, no, you're not. Do you send birthday cards? Do you go out for dinner with them? Do you call them? No, they don't. I don't believe there are that many great friendships anymore. We had a lot, and I've still got them now.
You got to a very low point in your career around, what, the early 80s? When you were, what, 26, 27, and your ranking was, I mean...
dropped.
Way out of being into the main draw of...
Right.
Even in the qualies for a slam.
Right.
How did you look into yourself and say, I want to work at this, I want to give this another go? Because it would be much easier to walk away, wouldn't it?
It would have been... Well, I financially didn't have any problems, so that would have been fine, and I was married. But you know, our marriage was a bit up and down at times in that space, but... deep down, I wasn't happy with myself. I mean, I didn't write it, but there was a book about Chris and I called Lloyd on Lloyd that was written by Carol Thatcher. And it was an awful book. I let myself get talked into doing it. I was in a bad position there. I said some silly things that weren't really me, but I just talked and said things. If you really read that book, which I don't, but I mean, I have done, and you can see the unhappiness that I had in my career then. Because I knew that I was wasting ability, but then again, it was like, when do you do something about it? It's like people tell you if you're overweight and you're going to die, and it's like, yeah, I'll do that next week or the week after. Yeah, but you know, I'll have a donut today. I'll start it next week. It's that kind of thing. And as I say, it was only till I was really rock bottom at 28 when I'd nosedived. I thought about it for about a long time because Bob Brett, I found out that Bob had a couple of people in his team, and one of them, Tony Giammarvo, who's still my great friend of this day, said, look, you should join us and have three in the team. And I knew Bob's work ethic, and I knew that I was going to get punished. And financially, I didn't need to, and I thought, do I want to do this? And Bob was very honest when I saw him. He said, look, I don't need your money. When you work with me, it's 100% or nothing. And if you don't work hard, I'm throwing you out. I don't care what money you've got. Don't care what you offer me. And I thought about it for a couple of weeks because I was living a good life. And then when I finally made the commitment, I said, OK, I'm going for it. And that was the best time of my life in terms of being proud of what I did. But I should have done it earlier.
Was part of the problem that actually a good player and a great player in a marriage is very difficult to manage?
It's very difficult, but I've told this to other people. If you marry someone who's great, or you marry someone who is financially in a lot better position than you are, a lot more, you have to realize what is going to happen in that way. And you have to put your ego at the front door and just you put it away. I was fortunate that when I married Chris, that I was already very well known in Britain. And I was a pretty decent star in Britain. So I was used to having people look at me in restaurants and, you know, all that stuff and whispering. When I married Chris, it went into a different level because then, you know, for a while there, you become like a crossover star through being married to Chris. But, you know, you also get into a marriage where a lot of times you're at parties and stuff, you know, they call you Mr. Everett. But I've never really had a big ego in that way. And I wasn't one that would snap back and say, hey, it's Lloyd, you know, that kind of stuff. It was what it was. And you have to swallow that. And I give a lot of credit to Chris in that way. She never, ever made me feel that I was, like, inferior. I don't mean that in a, you know, man and woman situation, but in terms of career-wise, especially when I started dropping down. I mean, she would say things to me and, you know, try and say, well, you know, do you want to do this? And I was like, ah, it's okay. And I wanted to be with her and help her as well. But that was almost a little bit of an excuse for me, I think, as well. I mean, I generally did want her to play well. I mean, I was obsessed with her getting back to number one. She was three in the world, which was, for her, a huge drop to go from one to three. It's funny when you think of it, but it was at her level, and I knew that she needed me around. And I got huge kicks up when she was winning matches. I mean, obviously, helps financially. But I was very, very proud of her in that way. And I felt like I was a part of it. But there was still that nagging thing to know that that it wasn't there. And you get used to people looking at you and saying, oh, he's on her coattails, you know, and all that. But I was secure enough to screw them. I didn't care too much.
But did you learn enough from her, given that you were on a daily basis rubbing shoulders with one of the greats of tennis?
Mm.
Did you pick up enough from her that you could put in your own game?
Well, I think that's what I think being with her probably helped me to go with Bob Brett as an example, because I saw the work ethic that she had. I saw the determination, but I knew that I would never have that. I could see it in her eyes. I could see it when she was on court against an opponent. And I asked her one time about, you know, when she was winning matches or whatever, I just said, well, what motivates you the most? And I was thinking, what would motivate me the most? Well, what would motivate me the most would be to win that trophy and to hold it above my arms and all that stuff. But Chris said, interestingly enough, the same thing as Jimmy Connors said. She said, when it motivates a match, she said, I can't bear the thought of shaking the person's hand and seeing that they've beaten you, to look in their eyes and know they've beaten you. And that, to me, was a philosophy. And it's not like a weird philosophy, that I think greats have that. I couldn't relate to that. All I'd be thinking about, yeah, of course, I've beaten the person, but all I'm thinking about getting my arms on the trophy and putting it up. Theirs was, I can't bear the thought that they could actually, you could shake hand and they've beaten you.
So it wasn't even as if it was she was looking one step ahead, whereas you were looking three or four steps ahead.
I was looking three or four steps ahead.
But it was also the fact that she couldn't bear to come off as second best on that day.
Right, right. And the philosophy was, when she shook that hand, if she did lose, which wasn't very often, was, you know, it's not nasty, but she would kind of look at them and I could see it, and she would, and I know she was thinking of it, you got me this time, but I'll get you next time. And if it's not next time, it'll be the time after. Whereas that wouldn't even go into my thinking, really. It was just, oh, good match, well played. I'm bummed I lost that match. But I wouldn't be thinking of plotting to the next time to play him, that I'm not going to lose to that son of a gun next time.
Was there also an issue for you? I don't want to play up an inferiority complex. You've talked very openly about being married to Chris Evert. At that time in Great Britain, your brother's name was plastered across most towns in Britain because of the David Lloyd tennis and fitness centres.
Yes.
Did that almost add to, oh my goodness, I've got to park my ego at the front door?
Well, no, not really there, because, I mean, I've sometimes seen some people, and I'll be honest with it, in tennis, whether it's Britain or otherwise, where I think that they've got things that they're not that talented, they're not this or not that, and you're a little bit of jealousy. I'm not terrible in that way, but with family, that's never been an issue in any way. I mean, family for me, you know, when David was as successful as he was, and when he became Davis Cup captain, and when he, you know, got the semis of Wimbledon doubles and then had his success, you couldn't have anybody more proud than myself and my younger brother and my sister. You know, we're all in that as a group. So the thing with David, that never entered my head. I just thought, you know, the only thing that entered my head is, and I do it most mornings, I bang my head against the nearest wall, because, you know, I realised that if I'd have at that time put £50,000 into when he started this thing, I would have made 10 million out of it. And I didn't do it. Not because I didn't want to invest. I had plenty of money. I was with Chris and I was on the road playing. I didn't know anything about investments. I still don't, to tell you the truth. And David mentioned to me, do you want to put some money in? I said, yeah, okay, whatever. And I put a tiny bit in, just because he said, well, why don't you put this in? Just because I think deep down there was a little tiny bit in his mind, perhaps, that it might not work. And I was on the road playing, and so I never really paid any attention to it, other than, you know, when it first started, I went and looked at the place, and I'm thinking, what has my brother done here? He's invested, he's mortgaged his house in this piece of land in the middle of nowhere in Heston. And I went out there the day that he broke ground. It was pouring down with rain in October, and I looked at this desolate place, and I thought, my brother's just bankrupted himself. And then 2 years later, boom, the whole thing went through the roof.
We've done a lot of playing down a lot of your achievements, but you did get on the Grand Slam Roll of Honour three times.
Yeah.
In mixed doubles, which, okay, let's be honest, in many people's minds, it's the fifth in terms of the main draw rankings. But nonetheless, you won three titles with Wendy Turnbull.
Yeah.
What do you put that success down to?
Well, I mean, it's corny, but obviously my partnership, I was fortunate because with Mixed, I'd played it a few years, but you've got to also remember in my day, it's the same thing in men's doubles. I mean, I believe that I could have been a really good doubles player. I mean, I was to a certain extent, but there was almost no money in doubles. So a lot of times, to be quite frank, I would play with friends, you know, people that were good guys. I had a couple of offers to play with some players in the top 10, but I didn't like them. I didn't like them. And the same with Mixed, to tell you the truth. I played with a few people, I'm not going to mention who, but they were just like friends. And I never really thought much about winning it because it was just another event. And you regarded the mixed doubles at Wimbledon, it's kind of the dessert. It's a nice dessert, I'll tell you that. It's the treacle tart and custard, as far as I'm concerned, which is the ultimate. But until Wendy, and it was Chrissy that suggested it, actually, and I was very flattered that Wendy came because Wendy had already won a number of slams in doubles and mixed, and then to come and ask me, who hadn't really done anything in the mixed, but, you know, she thought we could be a good pair, and we clicked right away. And then I took it seriously because I had, number one, I had no choice, because Wendy was a winner and she wanted to win, and it brought in a whole new thing, and we ended up winning three slams, and I sure as hell, I loved it. And I know it's the fifth event, but it's still a slam. And the other thing also, again, a little bit corny here, but it was one of the greatest moments of my life, not simply just holding up the trophy and stuff in the Royal Box, but looking down at the players' box and seeing my parents there. Because, you know, people forget in those days there was no money. They sacrificed all of their holidays. They never had a holiday, basically, for years until we could afford to take them places. So during the summer, David and myself and my younger brother, we'd be going on all these trips all around Britain playing in these tournaments as soon as the 6 weeks of the summer holiday. We'd play every week. Exmouth, Budleigh, Frinton, Felixstowe. My mother would travel with bed and breakfast. That was their holiday money. And they did that for all those years, never asked for anything. And I remember looking down at them and my parents, and I thought, and they were just so emotional, I thought, pay them back a little bit. So it was all a mixed doubles has been wonderful for me. I have to be honest, I'm very lazy, and I still am, and I'm trying to get out of it. But my two trophies from Wimbledon are in my house that I have now with my girlfriend. But I have to say, and she gets on my case, but I'm going to do it, but they're black. I haven't. It's
you need to get out your polishing rags.
I know, and I haven't done it, but I still, they're there, and I love them. But I've got to clean them up one of these days.
Got to love them.
I've got to love them more.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you talk about winning the trophy and looking down for the Royal Box. I mean, your first one was in Paris, wasn't it?
First one was the French Open, yeah, and I remember that one because it was after we had to go after the Open men's singles between Mats Wilander and Guillermo Vilas, which was one of the most boring matches in history. And I'm a big admirer of Matt's, and I did send him to him once, and he got a bit annoyed at it, and I didn't mean it in a bad way, but Matt's came out with that plan. I think he was only 18 or 19 when he won
17.
That. 17. And his philosophy was, I'm going to stay out here all day and break you down. And he did. And the rallies went on and on and on. And the match lasted, and we had to play afterwards, and I was getting nervous as hell. And we didn't get on court, I don't think, till about 7:30 at night on that day, and it was cold and everything. But I do remember that. But, yeah, we won the French, which was great because it kind of took the pressure off a bit at Wimbledon then, because we at least had one in the bag, you know. But not as special as the Wimbledons, obviously.
Can't let you go without asking about Davis Cup. Two things in particular. One, you were part of the British team that got to the final in 1978. You didn't play doubles that year, though you had played doubles.
Yeah.
But it was also a family thing because your brother David played with Mark Cox in the doubles.
Right.
You had some tremendous wins in singles. Were you a different player with a captain alongside you?
I think it helped. I think it actually helped with the whole team environment, to tell you the truth. I love being parts of teams. I liked county week in the old days playing doubles. I mean, I liked that. We grew up playing doubles. I loved the being around the guys. I think it did help, to tell you the truth. I think, you know, being in that environment and having supporting the team and playing for your country and knowing that, you know, if you lost, you know, perhaps the match would go, and all the camaraderie during the week of training and eating together and blah blah blah, because tennis can be a lonely sport in a lot of ways. I mean, nowadays, especially in my day, obviously there was fun, but, you know, you're playing against rivals, and it's a dog eat dog, and there's only one winner every week. But Davis Cup, you're all in it together on the same team. You know, it's so I think playing with the captain certainly helped me.
And later you were the captain,
yeah.
And you had a teenager called Andy Murray on your team.
Yeah.
We talked earlier in the interview about the wisdom that you try to pass on to today's youngsters. Did Andy Murray pick up any of the wisdom of your own experience as a player?
Well, I think Andy was, it was difficult. To say anything to Andy, he was already way beyond his years. And when he first came in the team, he was with Greg Rozetsky, and then Tim came along, which was actually the perfect team for the balance, because Andy was one on his way up and was obviously very good, but not good yet, not at the top. And you had two vets. So the limelight or the whatever was shared, whereas Greg and Tim both retired after we qualified to get to the World Group, which was a pity for me, obviously. And then Andy was on his own, kind of. I mean, Jamie was in the doubles, but the other singles guys were just hadn't come through, and we were struggling. And then dealing with Andy when he was the number one without the other guys around was more difficult. It was more because the team became very sort of centered towards one person, and I preferred it, to be honest. You know, when Andy wasn't involved, at least I felt with the younger guys, I had more of a role in the team, because with Andy, obviously, I'm not...
They look to him more than you.
Right, and also himself. I mean, he's not going to... He's got a coach for 40 weeks. Actually, one of the things I was worried about when Andy really became kind of the star of the team, Andy was already, you know, not the most pleasant person to be around for his coaches on the regular tour. And he was at that stage with Brad Gilbert, who was this, you know, was in those days, well, still is, but was very big new coach. You know, he coached, you know, Agassiz, and he'd coached Roddick, and then he came into the LTA, and he was the big man, you know, and everybody was in awe of him almost. And Andy was at that stage for a while. But, I mean, the abuse that he used to give Brad on the side of the courts, which we've seen all the way through his career, quite frankly, was awful. And embarrassing. And Brad took it because he was getting paid a vast amount of money. And there's a lot of coaches that have taken it. Well, I looked at it like, if I was coaching Andy and he abused me like that on the tour, I'd give him one chance. And if he did it again, I'd say, bye-bye, go on to the next. Because I wouldn't stand for that. Me personally, I wouldn't stand for it.
But as a Davis Cup captain?
As a Davis Cup captain, I knew I was going to have no choice. I couldn't walk out in the matches. So I was panic-stricken, but I came up with a good solution, because I went to Brad, who's got a very healthy ego, to put it mildly, and said, look, Brad, you're the main man with Andy, and, you know, I'm happy if Andy asks me a question, I'm happy to give him whatever I think, but I'm not going to go and tell Andy what he should do. Number one, he's a better player than I ever was, and number two, you're his coach, and I think captains should stay out of it unless... They're asked, unless you're dealing with a young player who's on his way up, who is inexperienced and so on. So Brad said, oh, yeah, I quite agree. So I said, well, during the matches, why don't you give me notes and tell me what you want to say, you know, during the match? And he said, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that, which I knew he'd say that. So sure enough, he'd, you know, give me notes. And I remember the first time this happened, we were playing and Andy was losing the first set. And I could see he was starting to get, he's looking around, he's looking at me. And I knew he was going to give me a blasting at the next changeover. And I knew it was coming, and I was petrified. You know, I've got all these millions of people watching. So I turned to Brad and I said, Brad, what do you think we should do? And he handed me a note. I can't remember what it said, something like, you know, coming on, hit to his forehand more or something. So Andy, as he walks towards me, he's looking right at me. And I know he's about to say anything. So I say, Andy, you've got to hit more to the guy's forehand. And he starts to blast me to swear. And I turn around, I said, he said it. So I pointed at Brad, right to the side. And then he just blasted Brad. And I just got his towel. And then for the rest of the match, just gave him his towel. And then he would just rip Brad. So I handled that beautifully.
For your sake?
For my sake. Yeah, not for Brad's. Bad luck, Brad.
But he was paid more than you.
Getting paid a lot more than I was. Yeah.
Are you happy giving advice to youngsters and also youngsters' parents? If so, what are you comfortable telling them in terms of how they should negotiate the big bad world of today's tennis?
Well, firstly, I would say that you're fortunate that you have a chance to, if profession, being a professional is what you want to be, you're fortunate that you're playing if not the greatest sport in the world, one of the greatest sports that you can play to, for life, and it is a wonderful way to possibly make a living. But what I would say now, looking back at it now, I'm a big fan of American college tennis, to be quite honest. And I think, you know, now the LTA is, we've got a lot more players coming in, the NTC, it's more professional. But looking back at it, I look back at my career, I was so lucky because I left school the first day legally I was allowed to. I got the hell out of Dodge. I hated school. I left at 15 and a half. Basically, then went up to, lived in a YMCA in London, no money, washed cars just so I could play at Queen's, and then started to make little bits here and there at 16, 17. But I got a serious elbow injury when I was 16 and a half, 17. I'd just left school. I had no qualifications. I was out for 9 months, and my doctor happened to be my godfather, Alan Murley. He was one of the top specialists in the country, bone specialist in Oxford, and he looked at my arm. Of course, you're talking medicine years ago, but and he did the x-rays, and he said that your arm is the equivalent of a 14-year-old man, what you've done to the ligaments in your elbow. And I'll be honest with you, he's a very honest man. It's highly unlikely that you will be able to have a career because you've busted up your arm so badly. You have to stop for 9 months, can't touch a ball, and I'm not convinced you're going to play. And here I am at 17, 16 half 17, no education, and I'm about to be in a career that I've given myself to and not be able to play at 17. And I got lucky, the arm got better and blah, 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 and the rest is whatever. But when you go to American college, you can get the best of both worlds. And look what it's doing now for the players now. They're coming on through it and they've got the education. To me, it's a win-win situation. And there's so many good coaches there. If you pick the right one with the right team environment, I would have loved to have done that. Not the education part, because I was lazy and I didn't like it, but that side of it and have all the team, I think it's a wonderful environment. My advice would be enjoy it, work your ass off. You don't have to be a monk or a nun if it's a female, but go for it. And whatever you finish, you'll have a great time. And there's other things you can do in tennis if the actual tennis side of it doesn't happen. With parents, I would tell them encouragement is great. Letting your kids go for it is great. But if by the time they're 11 or 12 years old, if they're not coming to you asking to play, then don't push them. Because then you're forcing them through your thoughts about what they should. If by 12 or 13, they would rather play basketball in the afternoon rather than play tennis, you give them the choice. Or you've got a great coach and they say, you know, whatever. Or my mates have got that, they've got a party at the school or whatever. Don't push it. Let them be the one. But if they come the opposite way, even if they're not that talented, and they say to you, I want to play 5 hours a day, you do it. Because it's the greatest sport. And for them to have a chance at it and to love something, go for it. As long as you can. And if they don't make it, then they don't make it. Life is too short.
John Lloyd, thank you very much for sharing your experiences of a life in tennis.
Thank you.
Some terrific stories there from John Lloyd, who's tremendously candid about how he feels he should have achieved more than he did. And it's fascinating to hear his take on the difference between his mindset and the mindset of great champions. If you know a youngster who has dreams of making it big in tennis, or perhaps the parents of a youngster with big dreams, do draw their attention to this interview, which is part of the Tennis Worthy podcast series. They can find it under tennisfame.com/podcast, along with the archive of other interviews and features in the Tennis Worthy collection. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening. We'll have more for you very soon. So long.